Welcome to the Hall of Blue Illumination, the podcast dedicated to M.A.R. Barker's legendary world of Tecumel.
What do we call this thing?
The Hall of Blue Illumination.
Ah, yes. We are once again in the Hall of Blue Illumination. Have we actually discussed what is the Hall of Blue Illumination on the show?
I don't believe we have.
I think we ought to do that.
We ought to do that, yes.
I don't have it on the tip of my brain, although I do recall it's basically a one-sentence description in the source book.
No, it's in Dragon Number 4.
Oh, okay.
The Hall of Blue Illumination is the location in the Imperial Palace of Avanthar, where the Book of the Great and Glorious Deeds of the Mighty Petal Throne is kept, and where those deeds are recorded. And so it is a compilation upon what is said to be leaves of gold of the Chronicle of the Empire. And so, therefore, it is a fitting place to aspire to have our podcast emulate.
Excellent. Who would gain access to this Hall of Blue Illumination?
Well, I'll tell you right now, you're not cleared for it.
Well, geez. That's what I get for hosting the call, I suppose.
Yeah, really?
I'm actually one of the books. I don't need to be cleared. I'm a sentient book.
Well, that's possible. That's certainly possible. Actually, that would be an utterly fascinating thing to toss into a game. Would be a sentient book. It certainly would be one of the AIs left over from sometime either before the time of darkness or possibly created during the latter times.
It sounds more like a latter times thing to me too. It's just like, who would make a sentient book? Lords of the latter times, because they were nuts.
Yes, actually. Well, you know, if you were suddenly cut off from everything that you held dear and had nothing else to do with your time, and, well, time was, for all intents and purposes, infinite, what would you do?
I'd make a sentient book, but who's to say? I don't know.
Who's to say? No, actually, who's cleared for it? Actually, interestingly enough, anyone who has permission of the Chancery, I mean, that literally could be anybody, can go and gaze upon the book and read upon its contents. But there is what is also referred to as the secret book, which has further entries and involves secret orders of the Petal Throne. Thus, when Professor Barker revealed some of those entries from the secret book, he was giving us a glimpse into the inner workings of the Empire.
It is cool.
Yeah. It's really quite neat.
And it's very Tecumel. I mean, the idea that there's a big book that contains all knowledge that is actually hidden away and hard to get to, but yet doesn't actually contain all the knowledge, but there's another book somewhere else that nobody knows about. That seems very Tecumel to me.
And in fact, even various pages of the secret book and the public book, but usually the secret book, can be impregnated with mind bar spells in order to ensure that once you've read it, you can't tell anybody.
That's a given.
I'm sorry?
That's a given, really. I just assume that was always the case.
That now that you know, you can't share it with anyone. You can act on it, but you can't share it.
Sure. No, that just seems, as I say, of course.
Mm-hmm. So raise your hand if you've started a new Tecumel campaign.
That would be all of us.
Well, it depends on how long ago is new.
Well, that's true.
I haven't started one for over a year, so.
I have started a new campaign, but it's not a Tecumel campaign, because I don't want to play in one and run one at the same time.
I have started a new campaign, and it is just fascinating the things that have been encountered, even as we speak.
What do you mean?
Well, two issues that I can bring up. Let me frame this to begin with. I'm doing a campaign that could be a bunch of other things, but we decided that we were going to do just the fresh off the boat start, partly because there was so much material for it. Mm-hmm. And also, frankly, in some sense, the players that I had, neither of whom have played Tekkenel before, they wanted to get the experience, as it were, that would match their own status, which is to say they don't know that much.
Okay, so the setup is that you have two players. Is that correct?
Yeah, two players right now. We're going to add another third or fourth in a little bit.
Is it an in-person or online game?
Oh, it's an in-person game. Yeah. And I'm expecting, actually, that I may add players from other places who may do things on a in much the same way as Professor Barger did. I'm going to have players who are doing things in the campaign, but who may not be playing with the primary group. And thus, some of the things that the primary group might encounter are the result of actions of other player characters.
Oh, I love that kind of stuff.
Yeah, me too. I would love to. Well, if that goes well, you should definitely share that with us, because that's something I've wanted to do for a long time and never really succeeded at. So,
well, it is an ambition at this point. And in fact, this weekend, I will be talking with a friend of mine who currently lives some distance away, and talking with her about how she might be one of the guinea pigs for this, as it were. So we'll see what happens.
We can compare notes as it goes, because I'll be doing a similar thing with the new Cthulhu thing I've started up. I've got my weekly Thursday night people in a particular location, and then I play with some people in Indianapolis on a monthly basis in the same or a similar nearby location. So I think there'll be some cross-pollination with plots and activities and the like. So, we can just see how that works.
Okay. I'm starting this campaign. I have two players, and they're doing the fresh off the boat primarily because they themselves don't know that much, and so they'd rather have their characters be people that not know that much. And so let's see where it turns out. Now, that having been said, we spent a fair bit of time on character creation, not because I wanted them to get overly invested in their characters, because things could get deadly, and I warned them about that. But because I wanted to make sure that they had enough sense of how to start, that they wouldn't treat it like a D&D game, which they didn't, which was really nice. And one of the first issues that we ran into was kind of interesting, in that one of my players, who is a graduate student at University of Wisconsin, he mentioned that he had a really difficult time identifying in any way with any of the gods of change, because in his mind, their doctrines were, well, from his perspective, extremely selfish, and he just didn't see how to play someone who believed in such things. And I ended up talking to him at some length about this, because I try to emphasize that on Tekkenel, there are people who are fanatics, and there are people who are time servers, the equivalent of Easter and Christmas Christians. And that because of the weight of tradition, people would end up worshiping a god whose doctrines, if they might look at, may not necessarily be in accord with how they themselves behaved. And in that sense, we got into a discussion about what does it mean to have a religious belief and a bunch of other things. And it was just interesting, because I think the tendency would be for players to, and this certainly happened in early Tekkenel, of people saying, yes, I want to worship that guy because he's cool. But if you look deeper, like these players wanted to do. It's like, oh, do I really want to do that?
Where did you start out? I mean, where are the characters from?
One of them is from the Southern Continent, and one of them is from Haida Pekala. One of the players ended up rolling, as we've talked about before, I treat the original skills role as kind of a heritage role, that's their, their standing in the society that they're from. And she rolled a double aught. And I was like, wow, you are a princess. You were part of the line of succession for one of the petty principalities of one of the city-states of Haida Pekala. And she picked up that ball and she ran with it.
How did the characters meet?
They met on the voyage to Jakala. So they assumed that they had known each other for some time. There's no particular need to find the winemaker's clan and have a fight, then become the best of friends.
Yeah, I'm just asking because I recently ran a short fresh off the boat thing as well, and I had a completely different setup. So it's just interesting to see how different people do it.
And also, rather than staying at the Tower of the Red Dome, because of this character's status, they decided on the moment to see if they could stay at the hostel of Biraku, the Alikiani, which is for foreigners of low and middle rank. And they found that they had a welcome there. And what was interesting about that for me was like, wait a second, even in something as simple as this, I mean, the Tower of the Red Dome is often the way that a fresh off the boat campaign starts. And it's supposed to be kind of like, this is really unpleasant and you want to go and do something else. And now I'm doing something with one of the other hostels there in the Foreigners Quarter. And, you know, this is something that it may seem small, but it did mean, oh, wait a second, I need to go and dig up some more material, and I have to think about this a little bit in terms of what did I want to do. And truth be told, the only reason why I dug up any more material anyway was because I had it. If somebody was doing this on their own, they could just generate it themselves.
How much description do you go in for?
Like, how much description?
Well, when you're setting a scene, I mean, some GMs like to be rather abstract with regard to the level of immersion of a scene, and some GMs like to describe things in a very immediate fashion. And it seems in TechML particularly, there are specific setting details that are important to get across.
What I try to do is to give the sorts of impressions that somebody who is new and unfamiliar to a place would pick up as sort of a first blush. And then I let the character's expression, you know, the player's expression of character curiosity guide how much more detail do I go into.
Sure, that gives you the lens or the focus for what you should be feeding back to them.
Yeah, because that's, I think, one of the big dangers of TechML is that you can snow people under with way too much description. And they'll be like, wait, what was on that first pillar?
Are we done yet?
Yeah. Are we done yet? Yeah.
Well, with I've done two fresh off the boat things, and the first one I did for Free RPG Day last year as a one shot, and I actually described or I keyed the Tower of the Red Dome, and it had this like little teeny underworld thing underneath it, and some of the nearby area, and so it was pretty easy to fill 3 or 4 hours with people kind of getting into hijinks just within, you know, a couple hundred feet of the Tower of the Red Dome. But the other hostel, the hostel of the Sa'alakiani guy, that, see, I have no visual anything in my mind about what that looks like.
Yeah, and truth be told, neither do I. It's not a place that I ever visited as a player character in Professor Barker's game, and it's certainly not a place that I think got anything more than a line or two of description.
Yeah, it's so just in the Jakala Key, right?
Yeah, that's about it.
And you be, it's interesting. I mean, I just want to interject something quickly, is that a lot of Tekumel is like that. A lot of Solyanu is like that. A lot of Jakala is like that. There are tons of places where what we have are at best a name and a thumbnail description of what it is like. And that means there's actually a lot of scope for people to sort of develop things and describe them as suits their own campaign or just their own interests and even whimsy if necessary. It's not as if every little detail has already been described in, you know, at great length. So point being, if that is something that is a worry, and I've heard people sometimes say, oh, Tekumel's too full with details, too complex, everything is, I have to remember it. It's like, no, that's not true at all. It's a sort of, there's lots of space for individual creativity if one is so inclined.
That's exactly why. Go ahead, Victor. I'm sorry.
No, I think just to put this in context too, one of the ways in which it can be overwhelming if you're the person delivering the detail is then that just simply means that there is so much more that you actually have to keep track of. Whereas one of the reasons why to keep things relatively brief, you know, you want to give them memorable details, but you don't have to go into a tremendous amount of detail because that's just simply more for you to keep track of. Wait, did I describe the temple of Kasarl in Jakala as having a colonnade that had a double row of columns or a triple row of columns, you know? And the sense of it is that, frankly, it's, I mean, there's any number of ways to think about this, but it really boils down to you should only be offering as much detail as you yourself are willing to commit to, you know, keeping track of. And that's not necessarily, you know, as much as there might be there. So this is also the reason to write things down and keep track of what you did.
Yes. Yes. So, okay, over the past few years, I've deviated from my basically lifelong tradition of writing all of my own material and tried to run some published material for a couple of reasons. First of all, to see, you know, how other people put things together and what is the experience of presenting that material to a group and, you know, what can I learn from it? And also just to, you know, do something different and grow as a game moderator. And after, I don't know, 3 or 4 years of this, I have come to the conclusion that it is far easier to write my own stuff because it's very difficult for me to keep track of all of the detail, non-player characters, locations, etc., that another person has created and put down in a scenario for me to run. So with regard to this Tekumel angle, it seems like it's a bit of a paradox because there's both a great amount of detail, but it's not the kind of detail that is on specific locations, number of colonnades at a temple. So there's a lot of individual flair in providing detail for the location, but the overall framework itself is very complex. Does that make any sense?
Well, yeah. Yeah, no, and I think that, again, with so many things on Tekumel, a little spice goes an awfully long way. You know? My feeling about this is that it's better to emphasize those things, like I said, that the players themselves are interacting with, because that also gives you the basis for remembering what it is that they are paying attention to.
Yes. No, no, I know exactly what you mean. I mean, from my own perspective in refereeing Tekumel and having two different campaigns and doing it, I tend to take cues a lot from player interest. You know, usually I tend to be a little bit more spare in terms of setting scenes and describing characters and so forth. But then as they take an interest and as more time is spent, additional details get brought out as necessary. Because I find, you know, if players are really interested in a particular thing, then that gives me both some scope to develop it, but then also it gives me sort of, oh, okay, they're actually interested about the internal politics of the Temple of Sarku. So therefore, I'll start developing that. But if that's not something that really comes up or they ask questions about or inquire into, then we can just sort of lightly skip over it, because, you know, what's the point in exerting, you know, making a lot of effort toward developing that when it's just going to be left behind. So I find that it's helpful just to sort of, you know, sit back and let players sort of, you know, develop things themselves, sort of see where they go. And then you'll know, okay, it's worth spending time on that particular thing. At least that's the way I've been doing it. That's how I justify my laziness.
That totally makes sense, though. I mean, you don't want to spend a lot of effort on something that is never used, especially if it's deeply keyed to a particular location and can't be moved around. Something that I've tried exactly. to do in the last couple games, and especially in this new game, very intentionally, is to develop some modular scenes and modular things that can happen that aren't tied to any particular location. And therefore, there's always something on an index card that, if the natural flow of the narrative isn't suggesting something immediately interesting, I can just kind of use one of those cards as a prompt to come up with something appropriate in the moment.
Yeah, and I think that's actually a very helpful thing to do. I have done similar kinds of things. I will admit, Techmel, it's sometimes harder to do that. I mean, it is and it isn't, I guess. It's just that a lot of times when I come up with ideas, they're very strongly keyed to a particular location or a circumstance. And I suppose, again, I can come up with, I can switch them around. But no, that's great if you can do that. That's probably very helpful. And that's the kind of thing I think that a lot of people would probably find useful, to have that kind of a thing available.
Well, certainly having a set of reminders about how, you know, things are structured. I mean, I think it's worth noting, for example, that every temple of Ti'i is going to have in its inner sanctum the inner sanctum itself is going to fork, and there will be one side will lead to one shrine, and the other side will lead to another shrine. And this is the why of the passage that basically you end up having always, even when you think that things are unified, that they will divide, they will diversify again. And that even if the shrines themselves are identical, one on the left, the other on the right, that in so doing, that what they are doing is representing the constant change of Lord Ti. And that's, you know, you'll find that pretty much everywhere. It may be represented somewhat symbolically, but there's certainly going to be something about that in every shrine that you're going to see.
Well, that's an instance of kind of a macro level detail that doesn't fill in the particulars of a location.
Yeah, and it also lets you, I mean, when you have little things like that that are built into how things are, you know, are in society. Like, for example, you know, I mean, the temples themselves lend themselves to it. But, you know, one of the other things is that no matter where you go, if there is a palace of the realm, you're going to find a room where there are scribes, and those scribes are conducting the business of the empire. Yeah. And there will be this, you know, just like the opening scene out of Man of Gold, where you have, you know, or not opening scene, one of the early scenes in Man of Gold, where there is the representation, the scribes at the very bottom dealing with the most trivial requests. And literally, it's a matter of passing things upwards to the next level of bureaucracy, which the Silliani love. They think it's great because it allows them to see how society operates. And so, something like that you're going to find in any place. If you were in a provincial town, you'll find that kind of thing going on. It won't be a Temple of Thumis, but the Temple of Thumis, in this case, in a Hanengakde monastery, or a monastery in St. Piet I, I'm sorry, is dealing with these issues, because it is the secular representation as well as also the religious one.
I can't remember if I brought this up on the show before, But on the topic of that scene, a friend of mine who plays in my Thursday game and has for some years has several PhDs and is not a Tecumel aficionado, but he did read Man of Gold. And his remark about that scene is that it reminded him of his experience in academia, having to get various messages traveling up and down a chain of command. And he speculated that on some level that might be related to Professor Barker's experience in academia as well.
Professor Barker hated academia. Or at least by the time that I got to know him, he was thoroughly done with it. His ongoing battles with the University of Minnesota bureaucracy were things that just, you know, whatever fun he had had in it before was curtailed by his experiences being a department chair and then a former department chair. It really was one of the more brutal experiences that anyone could undergo, going from being a department chair of a department that was supposed to be supported to a professor who had tenure, but who had literally no institutional home. It wasn't pretty. And in that sense, actually, I'm not so sure that that scene represented Phil's experience with academia as it might have been more his experience being in India during his Fulbright journeys and travels, where he had a chance to see how these things would work out, you know, in the period of time shortly after the Raj. You know. But, you know, I mean, all of it's grist for the mill. I mean,
well, yeah, you can't read into the narrative like that and extrapolate about the author, really. I mean, it's entertaining to do, but there's no way to have any verification of those kinds of observations. I just thought it was an interesting thing for someone who was an academic for many years to basically read Man of Gold as his first exposure to Tecumel and make that observation.
Yeah, well, in that sense, I think it's all there. I think that's exactly how Professor Barker operated, was that he used almost everything that he experienced in his life as being potentially part of Tecumel. Actually, that's one of the... Actually, wait a second. Now that I think about this, this does lead to something else that I think is worth noting. And that is, we have a tendency to think that people that are creative will take, you know, their experiences in their life and apply them to the creativity of their fictional setting. Okay. And that's, I think, reasonable as a general conclusion. But with Professor Barker, and this is something that I come back to time and time and time again, is that it does not, it's actually not that helpful sometimes to think that that was going on, because he had such a strong sense of what Tecumel was from a very early age, that there were things that you might think he would see some connection to, and he would have rejected outright, just simply because it just didn't fit. And it was very hard to predict what those things would be, okay? And that's not to say that his vision of Tecumel was, you know, unchanging. It evolved, it developed, it grew over time. But the thing about it is that Tecumel was always its own thing, you know, which is the other reason why whenever anybody sort of files the serial numbers off of something that's Mesoamerican or, you know, Indian and sort of plunks it down in Tecumel. And even I have been guilty of doing this from time to time, just sort of as a matter of, I need a visual touchstone. Okay, I'll use this. I think it's worth reminding people is that, no, that doesn't make it Tecumel. That might remind you of Tecumel, but Tecumel is its own thing.
Oh, yeah. This goes back to discussions I know you and I have had, Victor, and I think we touched on this in maybe a previous podcast, but I can't recall a previous episode. Just it always frustrates me when I hear, well, it's just like this. And it's like, well, no, it's not just like that. It's like something else entirely. It might remind you of that thing, or this might be a good, you know, visual inspiration for thinking about that kind of a thing. But Tecumel is really its own thing. I mean, Tecumel is Tecumel. It's not as you say, it's not, you know, pre-Columbian Central America or, you know, ancient Egypt or whatever. It's borrows from a lot of different things or is inspired by many of those things, but they're not, it's not any of them. It's its own unique thing. And, you know, which is why it's important, I guess, you know, it would be lovely to have more Tacamel art just to be able to point to people and say, well, no, it's not like that. It's like this thing, which is exactly what it's like. But,
Well, I can tell you that Giovanna is deep in the process, Giovanna Frenier is deep in the process of putting together the artist's guidebook, which will be useful for recruiting new artists to do things for Tecamel.
This arc of the discussion brings me to something that I think is very important if you're trying to create original material, and it is probably especially important with regard to Tecamel, and that is, what is authorial, I don't even know how to express this, what is natural for the writer or artist to create with regard to a setting or a scenario? So with Tecamel, I think that can be a bit difficult. Because you, Victor, for example, you can rattle off details about the Temple of Thumis and Rhi or whatever, and you just know them because you've dwelt in the locale in your imagination for many years. But I think people approaching this setting for the first time, or even after reading a lot of the material, might not know how to make that flow happen. So just let me give you a for example.
Sure.
So I know it's not Tecamel, it's Cthulhu, and that's what I'm running now, but whatever. So I have taken the town that I live in, filed off the serial numbers, and mixed in just a bunch of weird stuff to create a fictional version of the town that I live in with a different name. So now that's been very easy for me to do because I can just take things that actually exist 100 years ago, or maybe still exist in this area, and put a Lovecraftian spin on them to make them interesting and appropriate for the game. However, with regard to Tecamel and my experience with this Isle of Vra thing that I did a fair amount of writing for, was that I didn't have the local experience in order to simply look around me and call up details of my environment and turn them into something new that's appropriate for a game. I did a fair amount of research, and then I had a few things under my fingers to work with. So I guess where I'm going with this is, since you're starting a new game, and you know, others I hope will start their own games, is how can they feel like they know enough about the setting to make it seem authentic? There's been some talk of like, what's Tecamel and what isn't. And I know that's, I'm sure that's a major bone of contention throughout the history of the setting. But what advice can we give to people who want to do things in a way that seems incongruent with the setting, but is also natural to them? Does that make sense? It's kind of complex.
Sure. I can give you two pieces of advice right away on that. And I wish people would just pick this up and run with it. And they are counterintuitive. One of them is, it is almost entirely natural for people to say, oh my God, there's all this setting material, I must go read all of it. And the answer to that is no. No, you don't. There is enough material in Empire of the Petal Throne to start a game. And the reason for that is, you know, if you are trying to get a sense of where to start things off, you've got more than enough material there to give a very clear sense of what Tecamel is without going into more detail. And so one of the things, and this ties back to our earlier discussion about how much detail to go into, is that actually you don't need a lot. You really don't. You just need enough to give a sense of what Tecamel is on the moment. And if you are you know, concerned about whether or not you're getting a detail right or not, you know what? Like we've explained at other times, you can always look to the real world for, you know, examples of where if someone says, well, it's always like this. Well, I didn't describe the shrine that way. Well, that shrine's different because of this reason. You know, the real world is a complex place. Techamel is a complex place. Don't be afraid of, quote unquote, making mistakes, because they're not mistakes. They're merely opportunities to be more creative.
Definitely.
And on top of it, the other thing is that you should look at all the places where there isn't any detail, and there's a lot of places where there isn't any detail, as being opportunities for you to do your own thing. I'm happily sitting down and figuring out just exactly what the hostel of Biruku the Avakiani looks like. It may not be Phil's hostel of Biruku the Avakiani, but you know what? It's going to be mine, and I'm okay with that.
Yeah. That was my follow-up, which was, you know, probably most of the people who listen to this podcast are old hands at Techamel. So, you know, for them, it's really a lot of the same process. It doesn't matter how much stuff that you've crammed into your brain about the setting. Ultimately, it's about creating something new out of your own imagination that might be informed by what you know. But, I mean, going back to my comment about presenting other people's material, it's often more work to do that than it is to simply come up with something on your own.
Mm-hmm.
And in James's Friday game, we've moved to the southern continent, the unknown lands. So in some way, maybe for him, and obviously I can't speak for him, I'm just speculating, but maybe his hands aren't tied as much by what has already been written. And what's your experience with that, James?
Yeah, I mean, that is true. I mean, it's a funny thing, and I suspect this speaks to my being very interested in trying to come up with things that, while they might not necessarily be what Professor Barker himself would have done, but that he could have at least approved of in some way. Now, that's a particular obsession of my own. But so what I've done is very similar to what you described, Scott, like looked into pretty much everything that there is to be known about the Southern Continent. And fortunately, there's not a great deal of it. But I'm using that as sort of the framework. But what's it is liberating. It is very nice to be able to sort of go off the map, so to speak, and just be able to make things up. But my making things up is still sort of informed by my sense of what I think Techamel is like. There's some things that I wouldn't allow, I wouldn't include, like the famous Mechas Row that we talked about.
I was just going to bring that up.
You know, but there are other things.
Famous now, I see.
It is famous, but there are other things that we've seen other examples where we've gone off the map, right? There are other cultures besides the five empires that we have experience of. You know, there's the inhabitants of the Tanae Peninsula, for example. We know a little bit about them. We know about the gnome, for example. And they're strange. They're different. They deviate from the way that things are done in the five empires. So in a similar way, I'm rather looking forward to the characters experiencing other cultures that are not like what they're used to. And in fact, I know I've talked to Victor about this before. In some ways, I find that Techamel becomes more Techamel when you have characters who are from the Five Empires, Solyani in particular, encountering other people who do things differently than themselves. Because it's in that kind of a realization, it's like, they're weird, that I find that the characters. I mean, I know this was true when we were in the campaign earlier, when you were all traveling, when they were in Yon Kor and Zaya Lakiani, or Laki and the Kililamu and so forth, that they felt more Solyani, because they had to define themselves, or they found themselves defined by, they were the weirdos, they were the foreigners that did things differently. And so I'm looking forward to doing that in the Southern Continent as well. You know, you have a little Solyani colony there on the coast, and then this big, where actually no one knows how large it is, there's this unknown land to the south, and where, who knows what's there, and I have ideas, of course, but, you know, I'm going to be developing it as things go along, but I'm finding it it's as you were saying, Scott, I mean, because there's already sort of a framework there. I do have a sense of, and I wish I could define it, make a big list and say, here is what you need to do, of what is TechML and what isn't. And there'll be things that I might think that's a great idea, but I would never do it because it doesn't feel like it fits. I don't know if that's at all an answer to your question.
No, it's certainly an answer.
So rambling thoughts.
Two observations. The first one is that this strangers in a strange land kind of concept, where the Tsolyani go off into other cultures and discover their own nationality through contrast, is something that I think we see frequently in the novels. And the second observation, which I guess isn't very related, but I don't want to single out TechML, even though this is the TechML podcast, as the only setting where this notion of what is authorial veracity or verisimilitude or really just confidence in presenting the setting is unique to TechML. I mean, I would have great issues with Glorantha. I know nothing about it. I would have great issues with Traveler. I know nothing about it. So it isn't like this is a thing that's unique to TechML.
No, definitely not. Definitely not. And it's true. There are settings that have very strong feels, I guess, to them, based on what the creator had established, that people do have difficulties, or not difficulties, but they will think before they begin to add to it. TechML is not unique in that regard, but I guess it's one of the more famous examples, for whatever reason, that people tend to go back to as sort of like, oh, I could never referee TechML. It's too hard. But you're right. It's absolutely correct. I mean, Glorantha is a similar kind of a thing. As anyone who's familiar with Glorantha would know, I mean, it has some unique problems of its own, in that its creator sometimes changes his mind about things and then rewrites history, which never really happens so much with TechML that I can recall, though Victor might have an example if he could come up with it. Or maybe there aren't. I don't know. I just, what I mean
can
is
I quote you cases, on that, Victor?
Cases where Professor Barker established something, I mean, like established something, and then said, you know what, that wasn't a really good idea. Like, I've thought about it since, and that's not true.
Actually, there is an example. I can give you a couple of examples of this. I believe that the phenomenon that you're referring to in the Glorantha community is having something, it's referred to as getting gregged.
Yes. I don't think there's no TechML equivalent, strictly speaking.
No.
But are there examples that you know of?
There are a couple of instances of things where it's kind of like, one that actually appears in Empire of the Petal Throne, which is elegant in how easily it gets retconned, is that between the publication of Empire of the Petal Throne and the publication of Swords and Glory, the TechML source book, the gods of Livyanu go from being, the chief god of Livyanu is said to be something not unlike Lord Dumis.
Yes.
Okay. That's in Empire of the Petal Throne, which, you know, it's kind of an interesting kind of, oh, well, isn't that nice? Oh, they're all into knowledge and it's a theocracy. Oh, how interesting. You know, it sounds potentially idyllic. And forgive me, I'm playing up the difference. And then you get to the source book and it's like, the shadow gods are not much like Thumis at all. Oh my God. So that's one example. Another one, and this will show you just how little this really happens. There is, let me see if I recall this correctly. There are I'm trying to remember if it's Deep Purple Dark or Givers of Sorrow. I think it's Givers of Sorrow. There is one place where Phil describes the Givers of Sorrow clan, or the clan of Deep Purple Dark, I can't even remember exactly, as living in the vicinity of Fesiltum and worshiping. At one point, they were said to worship Vimukla, And at another point, they were said to worship Xi. And this led to something of a debate as to how did that work out. And Phil ended up having to devise a solution to it that was mostly in the form of, well, making declarative statements is a bad idea.
Right. Although neither one of those examples seems quite so strong as an actual revision, but rather instead there's a clarification and an expansion. It's sort of, you know, I mean, like the shadow gods, I mean, many of them do have knowledge aspects. It's not wrong, and you can always chalk it up to simply saying, well, from the Tsolyani perspective, they perceive, because, I mean, even in the source book, many of the shadow gods are described as what the Tsolyani consider them to be amalgams of, because that's how right. they look at the world, right? It's the same thing with Shiringai and the Salarviani, where I believe EPT says that they worship Avanthe, which is not wrong from a Tsolyani perspective. You know, they just sort of look at it as, well, you know, she's a version of Avanthe because, you know, these foreigners, they don't get everything right. So that's that wrong. But what I'm thinking of is something along the lines of, you know, an absolute, this was the case and it is no longer true. Not that we've changed the perspective on it and made it more complex, you know. And I can't think of any examples like that, but maybe I'm wrong.
I can't either. Yeah. I guess part of one of the things about this is I can just imagine if somebody were listening to our podcast, they would end up saying, well, it's easy for you to say that, you know, you can just go off and create stuff. What if I do it and I find out later that I'm doing it wrong? And it's that sense of doing it wrong, which I wish to combat. You're doing it differently.
Mm-hmm.
And you get to do your own thing. And you can find out later that at some point that's at variance with whatever Professor Techamel's and Professor Barker's Techamel would be.
Professor Techamel. That should be Professor our mascot.
Professor Techamel, really. There you go. But, I mean, not to get too far ahead of my own thinking, I guess the thing I'm trying to really emphasize here is Professor Barker's Techamel is a great reference in much the same way that an encyclopedia is a reference. But your own lived experience can vary from that, and that's okay.
You know, this is you somehow intuited a philosophical question that I occasionally dwell on with regard to settings, and that is, you know, what really is a setting anyway? On one level, a setting is a document that contains some information about a fictional land and its peoples, etc. On another level, a setting is what is in the shared imagination of the players when they sit down to play a game. So I think separating what is the thing that's written down and what is actually in the shared imagination of the people who are playing the game in the session is important, especially with regard to, am I doing it right? If everyone who's in the game in the session is on the same page with regard to the internal consistency of the world and its inhabitants, then I think all is well.
Well, and it's worth pointing out that Phil did this himself, that there were different times where what would end up happening is that we would run across something and we would splutter in disbelief and say something along the lines of, but it's not supposed to be that way. You know, I think discovering, for example, the tribespeople in the hills of Kilalamo, who were worshippers of Vimukla, but in the service of Lord Kasarl.
Yeah, I mean, from a, you know, so-called mm-hmm. canonical perspective, you might look at that and say, well, that's goofy. That doesn't make sense. But then, you know, why doesn't it make sense? Of course it makes sense.
Right.
Make it make sense, because that's how it is.
Make it make sense.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so Phil would do this to us. He would from time to time, he would end up giving us something or the time when we were on the expedition to the far side of the planet, and we found ourselves interacting with a black Sioux who was seemingly friendly. And that's happened more than once. You know, there was a time when we encountered Sue when we were in the Valley of Kash Kamai. And we had appealed for help because the valley had been overrun by Salaviani troops. And we were in the house of the first founder and had appealed for assistance. And we ended up getting a couple of Gray Sioux who were like, oh, what do you need? And we're like, what? I mean, need, right.
But still, there were no Mechasro.
No,
there are limits.
There are limits to this, I suppose.
But you know what?
Mechasro. You know, someone could.
Yeah, you could. And I feel, I you know what? I feel a little bad, I have to admit, about the Mechasro thing, because the point is, I can see how something like that could be used. It's not something I would do. And I don't want to give the impression that it's sort of, you know, my notion of what is and is not Tecamel, or for that matter, anybody's, is somehow definitive. You know, because I feel bad, because, well, you know, what if the fellow who came up with this notion is listening to the podcast and then he hates us because we make fun of the Mechasro. But more seriously, I simply mean, you know, I think with any kind of a setting, and it's true of Tecamel as well, I mean, you know, you get a notion in your mind after a while of what fits and what doesn't. And that's how you use it, too. It's like, what do you want to get out of it? What's the intention? You know, if some people, I think, you know, are very, very interested in lots of very specific cultural details, and that's the kind of thing that they want to include more of, and that's great, and I enjoy that stuff too, but some of it I gloss over simply because it's not really pertinent to the kinds of adventures that I like to run. As I said, my Tecamel is very adventuresome. I like lots of, you know, wandering about and encountering weird things and fighting and magic and all that. Like, that's what I get out of Tecamel, but other people have different approaches to it, and I think that's perfectly legit.
But yeah. What if you're the governor of a city? What happens then?
Well, you'll find out.
Well, right. And I guess in an example, to just finish up with the example that I was providing before,
sure.
As far as we could intuit, these Sioux existed from a time before Tecamel had been colonized, and so had no particular animus towards humanity or the other races of human space. And we asked them to, if they could help us deal with the Salaviani, and they said, oh, what, you know, what do those people look like? You know, we provided a mental image of what they were, and the Sioux said, oh, those. And they said, okay, go back inside the house and don't come out tonight. And the next morning, in the Valley of Kash Kamai, 2,000 Salaviani troops had disappeared. They were gone.
Dang.
We don't know what happened to them, and frankly, we're happier that we don't. Yeah.
And more importantly, your group was able to follow instruction and not go out tonight.
That's right. Whatever you do, don't read the moldering books with the strange script and the interesting symbols on the inside. Oh, wait, hey,
that's
my
game.
Yeah. That's true.
But I guess that's the thing. And this is one of those cases of where if somebody were first starting out cooking and they wanted to learn a cuisine that was not their own, right? Say someone wanted to learn, you know, even, you know, take Julia Child's Basics of French Cooking or, you know, Chinese cuisine. Would you spend your time reading every single, you know, authoritative cookbook of that cuisine and do absolutely nothing, and then hope that you got it right when you cooked your first dish?
You know, I this is funny that you should say this, and I haven't thought of this in many years, but when I was 15, I had a Thai cookbook for some reason or another, and I had never had Thai food before. So I bought all of the things in the book for the recipe, right, and followed the instructions, sure. And I created something that was, you know, pretty good. It was edible. I have no idea if it was anything like actual Thai cuisine. I, at this point, have had, I don't know, tens of thousands of Thai meals, it feels like. But, you know, it worked great. So I guess.
Do you still make it?
Sometimes. I grow peppers. There you go. Yeah, I grow peppers.
But that's sounds good to me.
But it didn't make the experience any. It didn't diminish the experience being 15 and not knowing what Thai food was like or any of that. It was still fun and delicious. So to go back to comparing this to gaming, which I think is what we're doing in the first place, is that you can go ahead and run a fun game and have a good time, and it doesn't really matter one whit if what you're doing is like what other people are doing.
Yeah.
There is that, but I do, I mean, the reason why I use the idea of a cuisine that is not your own, that you're learning for the first time, is for the simple reason that the only way that you get better at it, you know, better being you are matching your own ideals of what, you know, you think your sense of the cuisine is. Am I getting it right? Right? That's the question. Am I getting it right? And the only way that you can actually do that is if you keep making things, right? You say, oh, that's interesting. That's worth trying again. Maybe I should back off on the peppers on the next one, you know. And in so doing, you get something out of it by doing it. And I think that for people who say, oh, no, you must steep yourself in all of this techamel knowledge before you can run a game, it's like, no, stop that. Go get the utter basics. Go make your, you know, example of Tekamanami cuisine and enjoy yourself. Have a great time with it. Don't worry about whether or not it's going to get served at Autumn Thar, because that's not the point. You know, what the point is whether or not it's going to be something your players are going to say, oh, hey, that was tasty. Let's try that again.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
You know, as we frequently do in this podcast, is that we seem to arrive at philosophical topics of gaming generally, but also sometimes life observations. Because this notion of needing to know everything before you go out and do something, it's widespread. I think I've spoken on this before. For example, in the world of programming, web programming, whatever kind of programming, when I was younger, I felt like I needed to read multiple 1,000-page tomes in order to be able to write a simple script. Like, I needed to know everything in order to do something simple. But as I've done more things and maybe gotten a little older and perhaps wiser, it seems like simply going and doing something and then looking up the things that you need to know when you need to know them is more effective than kind of having a pathological desire to front load everything.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And you're right. It is a very widespread notion. It appears in lots of things. I know, for example, it also happens with people who study foreign languages, for example, that they often are very reticent to go and actually speak because they feel, well, I'm not a native, my accent's not perfect, my vocabulary is limited. But of course, in point of fact, you know, that's how you get better at it, is by going out and doing it and speaking it and interacting with people. And, you know, you get better at it that way. Rather than, you don't need to know the entire dictionary in order to be able to speak language, you know. But sometimes that we prevent ourselves from doing those things because there's this idea that you need to know everything, and it's wrong.
It's rooted in fear. This behavior that that we're talking about and all its manifestations is rooted in fear of failure. It's rooted in fear of being judged first by oneself as not doing something right, but also potentially by others as being an imposter or doing something incorrectly. So maybe eradicating or uprooting this notion of failure in one's attempts to try something new is the first step into really getting better at anything. Cricket.
No. Scott, yes, we believe in you.
Well,
and what you just said, I think, is exactly it. we should be uprooting this notion of fear. And it's like, go play the game.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter if the game is Empire of the Battle Throne. It doesn't matter if the game is Baythorn. Frankly, in some ways, Baythorn provides for a newcomer probably more sense of place than Empire of the Battle Throne did. And part of it is simply because Baythorn's benefited from, you know, 3 decades or 4 decades of learning on how to present the stuff. You know, and in that sense, you know, if people were looking for a double check, if they weren't so, if they needed more reassurance that what things are supposed to be like, Baythorn might be a place to go and get that. It certainly is a fun game to play, and I'm looking forward to having a chance to playing it when I'm at North Texas RPG Con in about a month or so. But, you know, if it's Baythorn, heck, if it's Sandy Peterson's adaptation of the Call of Cthulhu rules,
yeah,
for Tecumel.
That was one of the first things I ever played in Tecumel using those rules.
Well, on that note, I think, are we good? Yeah.
Thank you for listening to the Hall of Blue Illumination.